Okay, so I hope you've all had a good lunch. Our first speaker in this afternoon's session is Giles Waterfield, who from 1979 to 1996 was director of Dulwich Picture Gallery. Since 1996, Giles has been director of Royal Collection Studies. In 1999, he curated a major exhibition on the artist's studio at Compton Verney. And as Mark mentioned earlier, he's currently working with Gainsborough's House on an exhibition exploring artist paintings rooms, which opens in October this year. His paper today, The Picture in the Room, considers the evolving role and position of painted surfaces in interior spaces.
Thank you. Sorry. I feel I should burst into song, cruelly to join their cabaret setting, but I'll see how the talk goes. I would suggest that the 18th century saw the liberation, or at least the partial liberation, of the painted image from the confines of an imposed space and an imposed mode of thinking. That is to say, firstly, in physical terms, the painted image escapes the traditional hall or room or chapel in which it had been confined. And secondly, in terms of artistic programme. This might have been as an altarpiece, a site-specific work, with its character determined by the nature of the church, the church's lighting system, the requirements of the mass, the needs and desires of the worshipper. In the case of the portrait, restraint was traditionally imposed by the status of the sitter or the sitters within a work, and indeed by the relationship between the sitters in that work and sitters in other works, as well as by the role that the portrait would play with an interior, and that's not really something that changes in the 18th century. Or again, the artist's work might be subjected to the traditions of quadratura painting, in which the image defined the space, not only illusionistically, but also in terms of the actual physical mass of the interior, image and concrete surface being all one. In all these cases, patterns of patronage determined that the choice of location by patron or institution was twinned with the choice of subject matter. For a few striving and self-critical artists, demand for such confining professionalism may have been stultifying. For most masters of their art, not so. On the other hand, it seems, and here I'm indebted to Luke Sison of the Metropolitan, that already in Renaissance Italy, quite a number of pictures were being made for the open market, notably by leading workshops where the name of Bellini or Botticelli would more or less assure a sale. Particular themes might be expected to sell, particularly a devotional picture, which would find a place in a more private room, such as a bedchamber, where it was customary to hang a painting of the Madonna. Equally, at the top end of the market, some freedom of choice in subject for the artist may be detected. For the most famous, it was possible to choose the nature of the commission. Mantegna was lured to Mantua by the Gonzaga with the promise that he could select the subject matter of his commission, in this case, of course, the Triumph of Caesar. Equally, it was at the courts of the most prominent princely art collectors of the Renaissance that the idea developed of the independent work of art chosen for the artist rather than its place within a programme. Lorenzo de' Medici, for example, turned his palace into an art museum, pursuing certain artists for their work and most unusually hanging private rooms with groups of several works each. In such a context and with such a discriminating patron, the work of art achieved an individual meaning in its own right. I'm not sure about that sentence, but anyway. It's not far-fetched to see a connection between the creation of the freestanding work of art and a changing political and social system. In the Netherlands of the 17th century, the confined, site-specific work of art did, of course, remain an essential element of the artistic discourse, but the large new bourgeois market led, alongside such a continuing form of occasion,